The AP used to say the wheelchair-bound attorney. Now we say the attorney who uses a wheelchair.
And they used to say illegal immigrant, but not anymore. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. As veteran journalists flee Somalia, child journalists are enlisted, both to report and to smear.
The amazing thing to me is that young Somali journalists are still willing to sacrifice themselves just for the chance of one day ascending to a job where they can tell the truth.
And in post-revolutionary Egypt, a TV satirist becomes the leading edge in the fight for genuine freedom of expression.
It could be that Bassem Youssef will be the figure that first establishes the right to make fun of a president of Egypt in the way that John Peter Zenger, you know, before the American Revolution, established the right of the free press in our country to make fun of and mock the powerful.
And plenty more coming up.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
On the Media is supported by Squarespace, dedicated to providing a simple way to create a website, blog, or online store. Squarespace provides templates and tools to create a professional website. For a free trial, visit squarespace.com/media.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
I'm John Scott in for Shepard Smith tonight. North Korea may be planning another missile launch.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's escalating threats against the U.S. earned him a prominent spot in the week's news cycle. Actually, North Korea started to ratchet up the tension back in mid-February by announcing it had conducted its third nuclear test, and then increased the tension in March when, some experts believe, they launched a series of cyber attacks on South Korea. But it peaked this week when North Korea declared it was ready for nuclear war. Most news consumers probably felt ambivalent. We may be standing on the brink of the abyss, but haven't we been here before? In 2011?
Developing news from the Korean Peninsula this morning, North Korea has issued a strong warning in response to joint military drills involving South Korea and the United States.
In 2010?
Today, South Korea formally accused North Korea of sinking one of its warships with a torpedo fired from a submarine.
And 2009?
North Korea has launched a long-range rocket, the first such successful launch in its history.
You may even remember the weather when those stories broke. The sunny sky, the gentle breeze, the budding bushes. Charles Armstrong, director of Columbia University's Center for Korean Research, says North Korean threats are not only cyclical, they're seasonal.
Yes, there's a kind of rite of spring aspect to North Korea's belligerent statements. They almost always coincide with joint military exercises carried out between South Korea and the United States, which are usually in the spring.
What are these military exercises?
Well, the exercises are basically preparation for South Korea to defend itself in case there is an invasion from the North. And also, this is what particularly vexes the North Koreans, there's preparation for an attack behind North Korean lines.
So why don't we just stop the military exercises?
That's a very good question. One time it was stopped when Donald Gregg was ambassador to Seoul in 1992, that exercises were suspended, and it seemed to have the effect of calming down the rhetoric from Pyongyang.
We didn't have speeches about how we would go up in an ocean of flame?
Sea of flames, yes. That language was not used. There is always a colorful language coming from North Korea, but the general level was maintained rather than spiking as it does during these military exercises. They were resumed again in 1993, as was the belligerent and provocative language from North Korea.
Could you give us a rundown of how Kim Jong-un's personal saber-rattling style compares to his father's?
Well, his father rarely spoke in public. In fact, we only really know of one or two speeches that he gave, which were quite short. But Kim Jong-un has really seemed to revel in the public eye as the supreme leader. We don't know very much about Kim Jong-un. He's very young, obviously. It's not clear exactly how much he is in real control, and it's hard to say exactly how seriously to take his statements and where they might lead.
And some say that's where the biggest danger lies, in the fact that he's an unknown quantity and that he's changing some of the rules of the game and no one knows exactly how or why. On Thursday, some unnamed official in the U.S. government told CNN that they had intercepted private communications about the North Korean movement of missiles without announcing it. This is like throwing the old game right out the window.
North Korea wants to send the message, Kim Jong-un wants to send the message, that just as North Korea is under the threat of American nuclear attack, they're saying to the U.S., we can hit you too. So we level the playing field. That's the message that North Korea is sending now. That's something new.
Except North Korea can't hit us yet.
No. So it is, at the moment, a more or less empty threat. The real danger on the Korean Peninsula is that the South Korean government, which is a new administration under Park Geun-hye, the first female president in South Korea, is under a lot of pressure to react forcefully to any provocation from the North. So if something happens, this time South Korea might respond with an attack on the North, and that could easily escalate into a much bigger confrontation, which ultimately would draw in the United States.
If these stories about the inflammatory rhetoric from North Korea come out every year at military exercise time, should the media be paying attention to it annually as it does, or should they just ignore it?
I don't think ignoring it is a good idea, but perhaps the media isn't really focusing on the real problem, which is not North Korea's rhetoric and language, but the situation in and around the Korean Peninsula that enables this. A state of conflict that is held in place by an armistice, which is not an end to war, it's just a freezing of the war in place. It's been going on for 60 years. That's the danger of the Korean situation right now. Not that Kim Jong-un is crazy, that's another question, but that war, a real war, could break out at any time through miscalculation or provocation on any side.
So as we study this annual cycle, if we step back a couple of decades, do we see another cycle, an escalation of rhetorical heat?
Yes, not only does the rhetoric escalate, but the capacity that North Korea has to create damage is also escalating. North Korea now has nuclear weapons. They used to only threaten to make nuclear weapons. Now they're threatening to launch long-range missiles, something they have the ability to do now that they didn't before. Unless there is some kind of a solution to the confrontation on the Korean Peninsula, whether it's a peace treaty or some sort of normalization, sooner or later, something could happen that would take this beyond just a war of words to a real military conflict that would be a disaster.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Charles Armstrong is the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University.
More on the power of words. On Tuesday, the Associated Press omitted the phrase illegal immigrant from its style book. The AP now directs journalists to use the word illegal only to describe the residency status of a person, not the person himself or herself. A semantic nicety? Not according to Jose Antonio Vargas, the former Washington Post reporter who now runs the Define American Project, which has been campaigning for this change for months. Last fall, we spoke to him, and he made his case.
Actions are illegal, not people. Can you imagine, like, hearing this word illegal and knowing that it refers to you? What that does to somebody?
This week, we spoke with AP editor Tom Kent, who explained that the change is part of a larger decision to try to eliminate labels from the style guide.
It's not just about illegal and illegal immigrant. We like to put the focus on action, what people are doing or the condition they find themselves in. The AP used to say, the wheelchair-bound attorney. Now we say, the attorney who uses a wheelchair. We used to say, a schizophrenic. Now we say, Smith, who has been diagnosed with schizophrenia. It's the same thing with illegal immigrant. So we say, Smith, who is in the country illegally. We're still maintaining the concept of illegality, but we're just using the word in, we think, a more appropriate place rather than as a label at the ahead of the name.
When I talked to Jose Antonio Vargas last fall, he proposed an alternate way to frame the issue, and he said simply to replace the word illegal with undocumented. But that's a no-go as well with the AP. Why?
We talked about undocumented, but to us, it's vague. What does it mean? A lot of people who find themselves in this situation have plenty of documents. They have birth certificates. They may have passports from their home countries. Depending on the state, they may have a valid U.S. driver's license. The problem isn't that there's no documents in their pockets. The problem is that they do not have a legal right to be in the United States.
But what about talking about the entire population of those in the country illegally? Do the same rules apply?
Our style is not to use illegal immigrant, singular or plural. It's not just about whether we're talking about one person or a group. So we would talk about people in the country illegally.
Now, it makes writing a little more cumbersome to phrase things the way you now phrase them. If the underlying condition is well understood, why is it more stigmatizing to be called an illegal immigrant than to be called an immigrant who is in the country illegally?
Well, this isn't about stigmatization, and it isn't about politics on one side of the issue or the other. It's just an approach that we use to describe people in general, and it's been spreading through our style book, and we've come to the point where we want to apply it to the illegal immigration entry as well. You said that our approach now makes it more difficult to write. We're not sure that's true. We think that it's a little scarier, perhaps, in the anticipation. We've taken some AP stories and headlines and rewritten them pretty successfully. For example, we had in one story a reference to a pathway to citizenship for the millions of illegal immigrants already here. You can change that to a pathway to citizenship for the millions of immigrants living illegally in the United States. We've done the same thing with headlines. Within our 50-character short headline count, instead of saying cheaper college for illegal immigrants in Minnesota, we can write cheaper Minnesota tuition for people illegally in the U.S. It's still 50 characters.
What about the term illegal immigration itself? Is that still kosher?
Yes, we still use that term. It's still a fact that illegal immigration exists. That term is still available for use anywhere in the world where it applies.
Now, it happens that the AP style book doesn't necessarily govern only Associated Press journalists. It's used as the standard for much of American journalism. Do you keep in mind the fact that you're creating standards that will apply across the board?
We're happy that people throughout journalism in the United States and elsewhere use it as a standard reference. But there's nothing that forces any news organization to use everything in the style book. They're grown up enough to have their own style or their own exceptions.
Tom, I know you said this is an utterly apolitical decision, but the Republican Party has explicitly embraced illegal. Politicians are encouraged to use it because they know it has emotional clout. Whether you want to be political or not, this is ultimately a political decision. No?
We don't consider it a political decision. And people have asked us, what about the timing of this? You're doing this right at the start of a major immigration debate in Congress. I will admit to you that there is a timing issue here. This is the deadline for the new print edition of the AP style book. And that's the timing that we had in mind.
Tom, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Tom Kent is Deputy Managing Editor and Standards Editor for the Associated Press.
Coming up, a comedian tests the limits of Egypt's fledgling democracy.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. This is NPR. On the Media is supported by Squarespace, dedicated to providing a simple way to create professional websites for those who are growing a business, starting a blog, or opening an online store. Squarespace provides templates and tools to create professional websites. Users create sites that are mobile-ready, which include 24/7 support, a domain name, and e-commerce, all on the same platform. For a free trial, visit squarespace.com/media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. And this is the theme song for a TV show that's caused an international incident. Those who doubt that comedy can be a very serious business need look no further than this week's escalating squabble between the Egyptian government of President Mohamed Morsi and the U.S. State Department.
We are concerned that the public prosecutor appears to have questioned and then released on bail Bassem Youssef on charges of insulting Islam and President Morsi. This, coupled with recent arrest warrants issued for other political activists, is evidence of a disturbing trend of growing restrictions on the freedom of expression.
State Department spokesperson Victoria Nuland. The Muslim Brotherhood's political wing, the Freedom and Justice Party, expressed outrage at her, quote, unreserved audacity to comment on the case of comedian Bassem Youssef, still under investigation for violating some very old laws.
The law of insulting the president has been there since the 1880s, taken from the French law, which was abandoned in 1904. We are operating with a law that has been obsolete for over a century. It's ridiculous.
Out on bail, Youssef was on CNN this week, vowing to hold President Morsi to his promise to safeguard free expression. Later on CBS, he said he'd stay the course.
We're not censoring ourselves at all. And we're just like out there. It's like, yeah, come and get me.
A heart surgeon who tended the wounded in Tahrir Square during the uprising, Youssef is host of the hugely popular TV show called The Show. It's modeled on The Daily Show. Youssef is modeled on Jon Stewart, who calls him a brother. After his arrest, Stewart came down hard on President Morsi. Then the U.S. Embassy in Cairo tweeted a link to Stewart's monologue, generating more outrage. Then the embassy deleted the link.
For someone who spent time in jail yourself under Mubarak, you seem awfully eager to send other people there for the same non-crimes. And just like you, they will only emerge from prison stronger and more determined. So all sending comedians and bloggers to prison accomplishes is lowering the quality of prison yard athletics.
I always dreamt of having something like this in Egypt, where you actually have no limits in satire.
When we met Youssef in Cairo shortly after the revolution, his show is already popular, but not like now, not with tens of millions of viewers. Visions of his hero, Jon Stewart, danced in his head. So did predictions of greater reach and impact.
This is why I'm panicking.
This is why you're panicking?
Yeah, this is why I'm panicking. Right now, I'm not actually voicing my opinion, but you can't just be in the middle being neutral. When you start actually to discuss current events, you will have to take a stand. You will actually have to piss some people. This kind of honeymoon will not last. Sarcasm here is in Egypt, in the Arab world, is very new. Once you make sarcasm about a certain person, this guy takes it very personally. You see Jon Stewart making fun of McCain and he's hosting him the next day, right? Here, that doesn't work this way.
We are 5 years away. We are 5 years away from this.
We're actually 50 years away from this, seriously.
The incident has exposed growing tension between the U.S. and Egypt. Secretary of State John Kerry expressed concern over Egypt's direction. He said it's at a tipping point. David Kirkpatrick, Cairo bureau chief for the New York Times, says that Bassem Youssef, who went back on the air Friday, is a difficult critic to contain.
In his most memorable line, he was attacking the Salafis, the ultra-conservative sheikhs who've become quite powerful and very doctrinaire. And he said to them on his show, he said, look, you say to us that we're not good Muslims. We say to you that you're not sheikhs and scholars. And when they come back and try to attack him and make fun of them, well, that's a losing proposition because they're really quite solemn people. And he just turns it on their head and makes them look like total jokers.
And he is a very devout Muslim. But he did say that there were people who want to make this a struggle between seculars and Islam. And he objects to that framing. Is that the basis for the charge that he's anti-Islamic?
No, that's not the basis for the charge at all. There are religious people who want to make it a religious secular divide in Egypt, and there are secular people who want to make it a religious secular divide. And Bassem Youssef is neither of those, but it's more resonant when he comes under attack than when some other figure does. Because there have been quite a few of these people being charged with insulting the president or insulting Islam or insulting Christianity or burning the Bible. I mean, you know, the United States is a litigious country, but we've got nothing on Egypt. They love a lawsuit. You know, people, they value the courts because for a long time under Mubarak, the courts tried their best when Egypt was not a country where the rule of law really meant anything, to uphold the principles of the rule of law, even though the autocracy around them often prevented them from carrying out their rulings. And so people feel very strongly about the courts, and they love to go to the courts.
So what is the state of press freedom in Egypt right now?
You might say, well, look, a lot of these Islamist lawyers are filing these lawsuits for insulting the president. I think they're trying to intimidate the media. And maybe so. But if that's what they're trying to do, they are not having any luck whatsoever. People have been hauled into court on these charges of insulting the president. They turn around, they go right back on the air, and they continue to insult the president or say whatever it was they were saying. The most notable case prior to Bassem Youssef is a talk show host named Tawfiq Okasha. He's a Mubarak supporter. He hates the Islamists. He hates Morsi. The purpose of his show is basically to insult the president. And he was brought up on charges of insulting the president and inciting violence against him. He was acquitted by a Cairo court, and they cited some of the freedom of expression language in the Constitution, and they said, in this new era, we're going to let him go free. And I thought to myself, well, if Tawfiq Okasha can get off on charges of insulting the president, then the charge of insulting the president has been pretty much eviscerated.
What about less prominent critics of the government? Bloggers who don't have high visibility, wouldn't all this litigation have a chilling effect on them?
It would if you supposed that they were afraid. But that's not the Egypt we're living in right now. You know, the revolution is still in the air. You know, the Egyptian media believes that the relationship between the people and their government has changed. Right now, nobody in the media is about to knuckle under.
Where do you think Egyptian media will be 2 years from now?
Well, we're in a moment when the principle of freedom of expression is kind of a battleground. You know, the truth of the matter is that even the most zealous advocates of freedom of expression and the human rights groups will admit that most Egyptians right now think that it ought to be a crime to insult the president or to insult the prophet or even to insult the Bible. There is not the kind of expectation of a really robust protection of freedom of expression in Egypt that there is in the United States. And that's one of the reasons why these high-profile battles like the Battle around Bassem Youssef might turn out to be important. It could be that Bassem Youssef will be the figure that first establishes the right to make fun of a president of Egypt in the way that John Peter Zenger, you know, before the American Revolution, established the right of the free press in our country to make fun of and mock the powerful.
The signature accomplishment of the Zenger case was to allow truth to be a defense against the charge of libel, which it wasn't in England.
That's right. Although I think a number of the things that he printed actually were quite ad hominem and not so much true or false as just plain old insulting to the royally appointed governor of New York at the time.
And that is the true test of free speech.
Yes.
David, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
David Kirkpatrick is the New York Times Cairo Bureau Chief.
For reporters, nations in transition can be not only anxiety-producing, but deadly. Somalia, for instance, ruled intermittently by militant Islamists, has been riven by 2 decades of civil war. But since 2010, there's been a semblance of uneasy peace, a popularly elected government, and, as with Egypt, a flowering of journalism. Somali journalists have long supplied an anxious populace with information needed to be safe. But that reporting has come at a huge cost. Journalists often are killed for offending the powers that be. One was murdered just last month, and a dozen in 2012, the deadliest year on record. Gregory Warner, NPR's East Africa correspondent, recently visited the nation's leading news outlet, a place most veteran reporters have been forced to flee.
Last year, there were more journalists in exile from Somalia than from any other country. And yet, also last year, we saw more new Somali radio stations, new TV outlets than ever. So on the one hand, you have these seasoned journalists fleeing or dying or quitting the game. But the journalists stepping into their place, well, they're extraordinarily young. I went to Radio Chebelle, the country's largest news outlet, and I met reporters who were 20, 22, but also 18, 16, 15 years old.
And it's not a student-run station. This is a top outlet.
Yeah, this is one of the most popular outlets in Somalia. But it did actually feel like a college dorm slash war bunker because you have foam mats lying everywhere. That's where the journalists sleep. They don't want to risk going home. Passionate young journalists. Everybody's kind of gathered. At one point on my tour, I came upon a guy playing the Casio keyboard. And all the other reporters were just kind of singing along. Turns out this is a thing they do on Fridays. Here's one of the women singing. She's 20 years old. Her name is Hamdi. She's been a reporter since she was 15. At the time, I was listening and I was thinking, gosh, these people are singing even while their colleagues are dying. They're so brave. Well, I spoke to a lot of these young journalists on my tour of Chabelle, and they used this funny word when I asked them why they were taking these risks here at the most dangerous radio station in all of Mogadishu. This is Hamdi Ali Ahmed, the 20-year-old reporter we heard singing.
Because my hobby is a journalist. I think it's a nice future.
It turns out that hobby is a Somali word. It means something more like passion or calling. In Somalia, real journalists are like rock stars. For anybody in Somalia 25 years or younger, you know, they've never known a time that their country wasn't engulfed by war. And of course, if there's a crisis, first thing that goes on is the radio. And radios are always on in Somali homes. It means maybe the difference between life and death. And the news director of Chabelle told me that he hires young journalists. He actually said this because they are so passionate, they don't care about the risk of being killed.
And yet, a 15-year-old is not equipped with the skills required to shed light where there is only darkness, to speak truth to power. What exactly are they doing with their microphones?
Well, it turns out that if you have political ambitions in the power vacuum of Somalia today, then it can be quite useful to own a radio station, to sling mud at your political or tribal rivals, and to staff that radio station with relatively young, malleable, untrained journalists who are a lot easier to control. So I'll tell you a story. I heard this from a former journalist at Radio Chabelle. I promised him I would not use his name or his voice, but I will play some tape of his translator speaking. This guy's 22 when he starts working for Chabelle Media, but he'd already been a journalist for 4 years. In fact, he'd already been threatened to be beheaded by Islamists for his reporting. So by the time he gets to Mogadishu, he knows nobody in the capital, and he gets essentially adopted by Radio Chabelle. They give him a mat to sleep on, they give him 3 meals a day, and they promote him eventually to news editor. This hospitality comes with a price. He gets this email from the station owner, a London-based Somali businessman, and it essentially gives him the exact story that he's to polish up in journalese and voice on the air the next day.
And the story accuses this character of corruption.
Right. And he says, I didn't report this, and what's here is just not true. And in this bold move, he calls up the owner in London to refuse, and he's told, you know, basically, kid, you got no choice. You do the story, you hit the street. And he's really scared. And he's sitting in the studio with the news director, a guy that's known as Mr. Fantastic. And just before he's about to do the story,
we were together, me and Fantastic, sat on side by side. And then I told him, as a joke, me and you, one will go after this story.
So, me and you, one of us will go. And sure enough, by that evening, Fantastic is dead. He's been shot in a hail of bullets, entering into his front door, leaves behind a wife and 3 children. A few weeks later, the journalist himself telling me this story is also shot. He survives, finally manages to flee across the border to a hospital in Nairobi in Kenya. And after all this, what hurts him the most is that nobody from Chabelle contributes to his medical expenses or even pays him a visit in the hospital.
The example you gave me is horrendous, of course, but it's not isolated. It's not an outlier. These young journalists are being deployed like this routinely?
Well, Chabelle Media is particularly known for this virulent attack journalism. They've said the mayor of Mogadishu burned a Somali flag, then escaped overseas to have mental treatment. I mean, they specialize in smears and slurs.
Are they reporting the real news in addition to the dirty tricks playing?
They are. If you just turn on Radio Chabelle at any random moment, you'll probably hear more real news than attack news. It's actually been an independent radio station since 2002, and for most of those years, it actually had a really good reputation.
There are a lot of media outlets in Mogadishu. Is Radio Chabelle the only one that's playing this game?
No. One of the sad things is that after the power vacuum that happened when al-Shabaab, the Islamic militants, were pushed out of the capital in 2011, a lot of new stations started appearing. Their backers were mostly powerful people who wanted to play power politics. So the stations were very much influenced by that.
Now, Greg, Somalia was total chaos as recently as 10 years ago. Now it seems to have some semblance of a structured state to it. Is what you've described a remnant of the bad old days, or is it a new phenomenon that should give us pause about any hope that this country has forever righting itself?
I think it cuts both ways. I mean, you could definitely see this as just a rocky beginning to a new democracy that's transitioning from years of chaos, no institutions, no central government at all. Of course, it's going to look kind of messy. Or you could argue that, no, this is the very destabilizing, dangerous force that is holding back Somalia's chances. Another country that I've spent a fair amount of time in is Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, also, you see the same thing. Just after the Taliban fell, there was all this free press, encouraged many times by Western funding, and journalists became very powerful. And then it wasn't long before individual warlords and Islamists started their own radio stations. And it's interesting what Afghans called this. They didn't call it journalism. They called it zurnalism, from the Dari word zur, meaning force. The favorite targets of zurnalists were always the legitimate Afghan journalists trying to expose problems in society. There was this woman, Zakia Zaki. I don't know if you remember her. A few years ago, she was the founder of Peace Radio in Afghanistan. She was gunned down in front of her two-year-old daughter. She was killed after a vicious zurnalist campaign against her. So the fear is in Somalia that this kind of journalism will just keep the tribal conflicts fresh and not allow the country to heal. I think the good news is that Radio Shabelle is becoming less popular. The hope, I think, is that if the security continues and experienced journalists start going back into the country, which they've had to flee, then this attack journalism will be a kind of phase. The amazing thing to me is that young Somali journalists are still willing to sacrifice themselves just for the chance of one day ascending to a job where they can tell the truth.
Greg, thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Gregory Warner is NPR's East Africa correspondent. We spoke to him from Nairobi, Kenya. For more of his reporting from Somalia, keep an ear to NPR's Morning Edition.
Coming up, the imaginary money that's worth $1 billion, and the commercial that in the 50s was must-see TV.
What was it for?
Beer.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. At GatesFoundation.org, the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at JoyceFDN.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. 4 years ago, when Bitcoin was introduced to the internet, it was kind of an anarchic ideal, a virtual currency usable worldwide that wasn't regulated or backed by any central authority, bank, or government. Buy a Bitcoin and a little bit of digital money sits in your online wallet. That was its selling point. Bitcoin wouldn't, couldn't be caught up in the reckless greed that brought down so many banks and foreign economies. It also was designed to be untraceable and anonymous, so it would never be crushed under the jackboot of the man. It's easy to see both the utopian and dystopian implications of unregulated money, and that's why Bitcoin is such an inviting media story. But seldom has the coverage of a story had more impact on the story. Felix Salmon, Reuters financial blogger, wrote about the Bitcoin bubble for Medium.com. Felix, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Now, I described Bitcoin as virtual currency, but it's also kind of a commodity as well. And if you ask me, kind of a conceptual art project. What does it do? Who's it for? And how does it work?
It does many things. It is a currency. It does feel a little bit like a commodity. It's kind of a virtual equivalent to gold. The mindset is very similar, that you don't trust banks, you don't trust central banks, you don't trust governments, and you move to a new asset class, which is actually based on mistrust rather than trust. It's a way of paying for things on the internet, especially and most notoriously illegal things on the internet. If you want to buy illegal drugs and something like that, there's a site called Silk Road, which only accepts bitcoins precisely because they're untraceable. So it appeals to what I call the anarcho-libertarians on the internet, and there are quite a lot of them.
All right, I've got American dollars. I want to be part of the Bitcoin economy. What do I do?
The easy thing to do, and it's not actually that easy, is to go along to a site called Mt. Gox, which is the main Bitcoin exchange. And you can exchange dollars for Bitcoins and Bitcoins for dollars all day long, and people do. And right now, there's millions of dollars worth of transactions happening every day.
Let's now turn to Cyprus, where bank depositors have had to face the very real possibility of having their assets confiscated.
So the initial proposal in Cyprus was that every single person with a bank account would get taxed at 6.75 or even higher percent. Now the insured depositors at least managed to keep their insured deposits, but if you have more than 100,000 euros, then you're going to lose a huge amount of your deposits. So people are very worried. They've realized in Cyprus that having money in the bank does not mean that your money is necessarily safe. And of course, the other thing that Cyprus has done in terms of the Bitcoin angle here is that it has given the media a really concrete lens through which to see this story. And so what you found was a bunch of people in Cyprus starting to talk about Bitcoins, a bunch of people in the media starting to talk about the people in Cyprus who are talking about Bitcoins. And then you started getting cycles of hype, which always happen when you get an asset bubble like we're seeing with Bitcoins right now. Cyprus was kind of the grit of sand in the oyster shell, which created this massive Bitcoin bubble pearl.
So give me an idea of the scope of the bubble. How much has Bitcoin grown in the past few weeks?
In the last few weeks, it's gone up from about $5 to $10, which is more or less where it had stabilized at, to well over $100. If you bought Bitcoins just before Slashdot started talking about them in the first sort of mini Bitcoin bubble, then $100 investment in Bitcoins back then would be worth over $1 million now. That's an insane return.
Which gets to the media angle at long last. It's clear why we're so fascinated with this story. It's got so many man-bites-dog elements to it. But this is dangerous territory for reasons that have more to do with buying drugs from SilkRoad.com. How should reporters be addressing Bitcoin?
Well, one of the things a lot of reporters should do, frankly, is not be addressing Bitcoin, because every time people talk about Bitcoin, all that does is fuel this ridiculous bubble. And it's a really kind of profoundly silly story for all that I've just spent 5,000 words talking about it. I do think that when you talk about it, one of the more interesting aspects of this story is looking at Bitcoin does help us to think a bit about the future of money, what a currency is, what money is, how we're going to be paying for things in the future. If you stop and think too much about what is a dollar or, you know, what is a euro or what is a yen, very rapidly your brain starts to hurt a lot, and journalists don't like to go there. So if you're not willing to go there, then you should probably not be writing about Bitcoin at all.
All right. You just got finished writing a 5,000-word piece on Bitcoin. We are now speaking about your 5,000-word piece on
Bitcoin. Can we just erase this whole thing and not be doing this at all?
Are we part of the problem or are we part of the solution?
We are absolutely part of the problem.
Basically, we are captured in an Escher print of journalistic ethics.
I don't honestly think this is a major journalistic ethical quandary. If we go back to Cyprus, people in the media started talking a lot about bank runs in Cyprus, bank runs even in the rest of Europe. And reporting and talking about bank runs in the media is an incredibly dangerous and can be a very irresponsible thing to do it if you do it the wrong way, because that kind of reporting can turn into a self-fulfilling prophecy. reporting about Bitcoin is a fluff piece, which the vast majority of people are going to go, that's crazy, I can ignore that. And so, frankly, this is a lot less dangerous than some of the things I've seen out there.
Felix, thank you very much.
Bob, thank you.
Felix Salmon is a financial blogger for Reuters. He wrote The Bitcoin Bubble and the Future of Currency for Medium.com.
On Sunday, the critically acclaimed AMC series Mad Men launches its sixth season. In the series, Mad Men, a portmanteau of Madison Avenue advertising men, ply their trade through the 60s, when America went from Eisenhower gray and white to go-go day-glow. We see the ad men scrambling to match their ads to the new era. But in 1955, one real ad man saw the future of advertising, and it was funny. Although the product, Peel's Beer, was sold only in and around New York, its pitchmen became national celebrities. WNYC's Sarah Fishko has more.
Ladies, controlling household odors is an all-day job.
It was the middle of the 1950s. Television was young. Television advertising was, well, unrealized, you could say.
So, play safe. Odor condition your home with...
It was still very hard sell.
Advertising veteran Larry Oakner is the author of And Now a Few Laughs from Our Sponsor. He recalls the early ads for the painkiller Anacin.
Little hammers going on in people's heads. Hard sell was really the tenor of the times.
Yes, Old Gold, the cigarette with nearly 200 years of tobacco know-how.
There were dancing cigarette packages and stuff like that.
Ed Graham, a young and rubicam copywriter then in his 20s, was stuck doing unglamorous commercials for small appliances.
So I worked on GE fans and GE vacuum cleaners. Reach easy, roll easy.
Graham had the idea that commercials with characters and humor could sell too, softly. And he set out to redo a local beer campaign that he thought was dismal, not up to the standards of Young and Rubicam.
Weiner was doing a lot of good stuff, but I found one that seemed pretty horrible.
The product was a Brooklyn-brewed beer named Peel's. Graham had been a fan of a droll and increasingly popular comedy team.
To all of you who would like to be like Bob and Ray, send for our special book, How to Be Like Bob and Ray.
Would you like to grow up to be like us, boys and girls? Would
Bob
like
Elliott and Ray Goulding, who'd been working in radio in the 40s and early 50s.
Simply address a postcard to the Bob and Ray Finishing School.
No, it's the Bob and Ray Success Clinic.
So Graham designed, expressly for them, a campaign around two fictional brothers, Bert and Harry Peel. The brothers, stylistic opposites, often disagreed on salesmanship.
To the brothers Peel, others kneel.
Well, that doesn't say anything about how good our beer is. Peel's is delicious.
Serve Peel's with your meal.
Top Madison Avenue agency Young and Rubicam was mostly perplexed by the idea. Bob Elliott, the Bob of Bob and Ray, and the voice of Harry Peel, remembers it was an uphill battle to sell the campaign.
For that time, it was a real excursion into who knows where, you know.
We'll tell the whole wide world. We'll put it on television.
From where we sit, where character and humor are common in spots...
I never know when you're kidding, Bert.
It may not sound like a revolution, but it was. Finally, one executive at the agency approved the idea. They would record tracks, both scripted and improvised, and create cartoon characters to fit the voices.
This is Harry Peel speaking to you from the main rifle range beneath the Peel's Brewery in Brooklyn, New York. Peel's, as you know, is the most delicious beer.
The wang is up!
That was the voice of my brother, Bert.
The spots featuring short, hard-selling Bert Peel and tall, mild-mannered Harry Peel began to run in 1955.
Bert thought you'd be interested in why Mr. Dupre prefers our refreshing beer. Unfortunately, he speaks no English.
Never mind, Harry, I'll handle this. Monsieur Dupre, why do you prefer Peel's beer?
Pretty soon, Bob and Ray started to become Bert and Harry. They began to think like Bert and Harry, maybe because they knew all about them from creator Graham.
What I did for Bob and Ray is I wrote biographies of Harry and Bert, where they went to high school in Brooklyn, and then I followed their careers in early business. Harry had invented a colloidal suspension as a chemist. And although I don't really know what that means, it sounded kind of good.
Harry Peel, the tall one. Bert Peel, average in stature.
And Bert was in sales.
Actually tastes best of all.
Because it's the driest of all.
Try some at your local tavern.
If they have none, congregate elsewhere.
Where they carry a product of Peel Brothers.
Throat-wise, it's delicious.
Yes.
The chemistry of Bert and Harry clicked in a particular way. For one thing, Bob and Ray, for all their prior work together, had only once before played brothers.
We did do a couple of band leaders who were supposed to be twins, the McBeebe twins, and they talked in closely in unison.
Hiya, Bob and Ray. Gee, it's certainly great to be back here.
Suppose that I could follow whatever Ray said. And I got pretty good at it.
You want to do another song from our new album.
But the Peels, Bert and Harry, were characters.
Well, they were believable, even though they were animated.
The animation was by Jack Sidebotham.
Everything Jack Sidebotham touched had a certain warmth to it, which they really needed because Bert Peel could be a pain in the neck.
Peels taste best of all because it's driest of all. Remember that, viewers. Peels.
Excuse me, Bert.
Jack's rendition of him made him seem like a lovable guy.
And unlike now, there was at least a little more time for Graham and his gang to play around with.
We had a full minute to work in. Almost all the ones people remember were minute commercials. And I think if we were limited to 20 seconds, we probably never would have gotten the character development that we did get.
All this would hardly be worth mentioning if this hadn't become a genuine television advertising phenomenon for a long stretch. Peel's beer numbers shot up wherever the commercials ran. Fan clubs sprang up around Bert and Harry.
Presenting Bert Peel as Mr. Smoothie.
Smoothie. Come in, my fragile princess. Let me get you something. A beer, perhaps?
We'd get calls on the street if we were walking together, and it would be, hey, Bert and Harry, how are you? Instead of a twosome, we became a foursome.
Reportedly, people actually stayed home just to catch the latest Bert and Harry commercial. Newspapers, and this had never happened, printed the commercial schedule so people would know when they could catch Bert and Harry's latest antics.
A pristine glass of Peel's light beer, am I? A host of wondrous things.
But life, commerce, and culture are fickle. After years of the brothers, the Bert and Harry spots burned out, despite protests from many thousands of devoted fans. Peel's beer had begun to underperform. A new era, the early 60s, called for new, slicker advertising.
There's only one way to get the honest taste of Peel's, the hard way. In a world of false values, that's something nice to think about.
A forgettable follow-up to a landmark campaign.
There was such an innocence in the 50s.
Larry Oakner.
You had two medium. You had TV and radio. You could make an impression. You could stand out.
You could, and they did. Everything was about to change as the 50s gave way to the 60s. Peel's added one more thing to the list. Commercials could now be better than the products they advertised and more amusing than the programs they supported. They could deliver something beyond hard sell hammers in the head. For better or for worse, there was much more soft sell to come. For WNYC, I'm Sarah Fischko.
Sarah Fischko produces the Fischko Files for WNYC. It's possible that when it comes to advertising, the mother of invention is actually beer. And if so, Budweiser is probably the mother of mothers, so to speak, with its innovative mascots like 1987's bull terrier Spuds McKenzie.
There he is. What a happening dude.
A super party animal. Yeah. His name is Spuds McKenzie.
1995's Frogs.
Bud. Bud. Wise Bud.
And 1999's this.
Yo.
What's that?
With that.
Hold on.
So what's up, B?
Watching the game, having a bud.
Go back further to, say, 1984, and companies like Old Milwaukee used more traditional pitches.
Taste as great as their name.
You know, guys, it doesn't get any better than this.
But over the past year, the Pabst Brewing Company, which makes Old Milwaukee, has honed the soft sell to a sharp edge, reminiscent of the brothers Bert and Harry Peel. The ads, which star Will Ferrell, air only in tiny markets and generally feature him doing things in locations clearly recognizable to those local audiences, like fishing in the Mississippi River in Davenport, Iowa.
When I'm not too busy being a big-time Hollywood phony, I like to come out here to Davenport. Sit on my favorite log and crack open a ice-cold Old Milwaukee. Something I do. Well, truth be told, I've never been to Davenport. This is my first time, but it's something I want to do, you know? I mean, it looks like something it'd be fun to do. Come out here and sit on a log and drink old Milwaukee.
Or waking up in pajamas on top of a building in Terre Haute, Indiana.
I do not know how I got here. I was over in Illinois. Some guys jumped me, punched me in the face. They kicked me pretty good, too. Ow! I woke up here on this building in Terre Haute. I'm not complaining. Some workers must have been here tarring the roof. They left three old Milwaukee beers. Just doesn't get any better than this.
Or, during this year's Super Bowl, making out with a woman on a bus in an ad with no dialogue that aired only in Sherman, Texas, Ardmore, Oklahoma, and Glendive, Montana. The Pabst Company has been tight-lipped about the campaign, saying only that Ferrell does the ads for free and that he does pretty much whatever he wants. And what he does is summon up the regional charm of Bert and Harry with a new twist. Because they air locally, and only locally, these ads are almost guaranteed to go viral. Pabst saves buckets of money by buying cheap regional ad time instead of national spots, and then sits back while the internet gathers the eyeballs. That Super Bowl ad I mentioned, that aired only in three tiny markets, has over 3.5 million views on YouTube. Remember when newspapers were compelled to print the scheduled airtimes of the Peels commercials so that people could find them? Well, everything old is new again. Get funny people. Set them free. Turns out, with those two simple ingredients, it's easier to brew delicious buzz than beer.
Old Milwaukee just doesn't get any better than this. I mean, sure, the moment my first child was born, that was pretty special. And I'll never forget the time I saw the Grand Canyon for the first time. No, you know what? I take that back. It just doesn't get any better than this. Those things are meaningless to me. Pop one open. You'll see what I mean.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurkhman, and Chris Neary. We had more help from Krista Ripple, Ravenna Koenig, and Alex Hall. And the show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rick Kwan.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news and our boss. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.